This book offers a radical take on how to increase your freedom in an unfair world.
It certainly does. And honestly, it does so by asking you to accept some very uncomfortable truths right out of the gate. It asks you to stop looking for, a referee to come and save you.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are tackling a manuscript that is, well, it's provocative, it's gritty.
That's one word for it.
It's got a title that you probably wouldn't want to say too loudly in front of your grandmother, but underneath the language, it is a sophisticated manual on how to navigate a broken world.
Right.
We are looking at a book titled Paragentism: How to Thrive in a World of Fuckwits.
It's a title that definitely grabs you by the lapels.
It does. And before we get into the fuckwits part, because I know everyone is waiting for that definition, we need to get the main word straight, because it's a made-up word, right?
It is a neologism, yes. And it's pronounced paragentism.
Paragentism. Got it.
Exactly. And we should probably break it down because the etymology actually, it really matters here. Para means beyond or across. Agent refers to a self-interested actor, someone who has agency.
Okay, an individual with choice.
Exactly. And ism is, the practice or philosophy of something.
So if you put it all together.
The practice of going beyond standard frameworks to preserve your agency.
So beyond agencyism, something like that.
In a nutshell, it's about realizing that the standard rules of the game, the social contract, the bureaucracy, all the polite expectations,
The things we're taught to follow.
yes, that they're often designed to strip you of your power. Paragentism is the toolkit for getting that power back.
Which brings us to the subtitle, How to Thrive in a World of Fuckwits. Now, usually when someone writes a book about idiots or fools, it's a rant.
Yeah, it's just venting.
It's just venting. But this feels different.
It is very different. And I think this is crucial for you to understand right up front. In the context of this book, fuckwit is not an insult.
It really sounds like an insult.
It does, doesn't it?
Okay.
But the author frames it as a technical term. He calls it a functional diagnosis.
A functional diagnosis. Okay, unpack that for us.
The author defines a fuckwit as a person, or, and this is the important part, a system that acts in ways that erode agency.
Ah, so it's about the outcome of the action.
That's the litmus test. Do your actions reduce your own freedom to choose? Do your actions reduce the freedom of the people around you? If the answer is yes, then you fit the diagnosis.
So intelligence has nothing to do with it.
Zero. None. You can be a Nobel Prize winner. You can be the most well-intentioned, kind-hearted person in the room. But if your actions create a net loss of agency, if you create bottlenecks, if you enforce rules that make no sense, if you paralyze decision-making, then you are functionally a fuckwit.
That's actually a little terrifying
Yeah.
because it means I could be the fuckwit in a situation.
We all can. The author actually starts by saying something like, "Whenever I use the word fuckwit, assume I'm talking about myself first."
So it's about self-awareness.
It's about recognizing that we are all prone to these behaviors that just, clog up the gears of life.
So what's in it for me here? Why should you spend the next hour with us on this?
Because I think most of us feel trapped. We feel trapped by bureaucracy, by social expectations, by unfair rules, bills, bosses who don't get it.
We feel like passengers.
We feel like passengers in a vehicle that is just careening off the road. Paragentism is a manual on how to stop being a passenger and start steering.
Steering, that's the key word, isn't it?
It is. It's about rejecting that feeling of imprisonment. It's about building a toolkit, these mental models and tactical moves to get your agency back.
To decide for yourself.
For decide for yourself rather than having the system decide for you.
I really like that image, moving from passenger to driver. But before we can drive, we have to look at the road conditions.
Like
And the
that.
author starts with a segment on what he calls structural truths. And this is where he really challenges the way most of us were raised.
Oh, absolutely. We are raised on a diet of fairness.
Work hard, play by the rules, you'll get your reward.
Wait your turn. It'll all even out in the end, the author just says. No, it won't. The world is not fair, and it never was.
And he uses this really vivid analogy about a forest to explain this. Can you walk us through that one?
Sure. Imagine two seeds. They fall to the forest floor at the exact same moment. They are genetically identical.
Same potential.
Same species, same potential. But one seed lands in this perfect patch of rich soil. It gets a beam of sunlight. The other lands 2 feet away in the shadow of a giant oak tree on a hard piece of rock.
Okay, so complete luck of the draw.
Pure chance. Now watch what happens over time. The first seed sprouts, Because it has light and soil, it grows leaves very quickly.
Right.
Those leaves capture more light, which gives it energy to grow deeper roots, which find more water.
The advantage just keeps compounding.
The advantage compounds. It becomes a massive tree.
And the second seed, the one in the shade.
It struggles. It gets no light. It stays small. It might even die. Now, here's the question the author poses. Is the forest unfair?
Well, from the perspective of that second seed, absolutely. It didn't do anything wrong. It just got a bad roll of the dice.
But does the forest care? Does nature have some kind of mechanism to say, hey, that big tree is taking way too much light. Let's redistribute some of those photons to the little guy.
No, that's just physics and biology playing out.
Exactly. Unfairness, he argues, is the mechanism of reality. His point is that we make ourselves miserable because we expect the world to act like a referee or a parent.
We expect it to step in and fix the imbalance.
And it won't. Reality is just a series of feedback loops. And he argues that acknowledging this, that fairness is a human invention, not some natural law. That's the first step to agency.
He takes this a step further with the Heinz problem. This is a classic from, what, Ethics 101 classes?
It is. Kohlberg's stages of moral development. The scenario is simple, but it's brutal.
Lay it out for us.
The man named Heinz has a dying wife. There's one drug that can save her, developed by a local chemist. But the chemist is charging 10 times what it costs to make.
Just pure price gouging.
Essentially. Heinz can't afford it. He begs. He borrows from everyone he knows, but he can't raise the money. The chemist refuses to lower the price.
So the dilemma is, does Heinz steal the drug?
Right. And if you're in a philosophy class, you spend hours debating this. Stealing is wrong because it violates property rights and the social order, versus saving a life is a higher moral duty than protecting profit.
And usually the right answer depends on which philosopher you ask. You know, Kant would say one thing, a utilitarian would say something completely different.
But the author looks at this and says, standard ethics collapse here. They fail.
Why?
Because both choices result in a wrong. If he steals, he's a criminal. If he doesn't, his wife is a corpse.
There's no clean win.
There is no fair outcome available to Heinz. The world has presented him with a situation where fairness simply does not exist. There are only trade-offs, power, and consequences.
So clinging to the idea that there must be a fair solution actually paralyzes you.
That's his argument. Heinz has to stop worrying about what is right in the abstract and decide what consequence he is willing to live with.
It's a shift from moral reasoning to what he'd call strategic reality.
Precisely. And this leads us into perhaps the most controversial part of the book's early chapters, the fairness paradox.
Yeah, this is where listeners might want to buckle up a bit. The author argues that when you try to force a complex system to be fair,
specifically when you try to engineer equality of outcome.
Right. You often make the system less good. You actually degrade its competence.
And he doesn't just say this as an opinion. He brings receipts, so to speak. He uses a case study from the Queensland University of Technology, or QUT.
So walk us through the math here, because he relies very heavily on the numbers.
He does. He analyzes the executive leadership team at QUT at a specific point in time. He notes that 5 out of the 8 executive roles were held by women.
That's 62.5%.
Correct.
Now, in a vacuum, that sounds like a success story for gender equity initiative.
It does.
Mm.
But the author asks a very different question. He asks, what is the probability of this happening by accident, assuming you were just hiring the best person for the job, regardless of anything else?
And to answer that, you need to know who the best people are. You need to know the size of the talent pool.
Right. You need the pool. He notes that in academia, the pool of senior female academics, the people with the experience and credentials to actually be a deputy vice chancellor, is typically around 30% to 35%.
Okay.
That's just the demographic reality of that specific workforce tier at that time.
So if the pool of available qualified candidates is about 35% female, but the hiring outcome is over 62% female.
He runs a chi-square test, which is a statistical test used to determine if an observed distribution differs from what you'd expect just by chance.
Can you put that in plain English for us?
It measures how likely it is that a result is just random luck. And his calculation shows that the probability of this executive mix happening by pure merit-based selection, just picking the best resume from the pile, is about 4.5%.
Less than 1 in 20.
Correct. So, statistically speaking, it is highly unlikely this was a coincidence.
So what's he arguing?
He argues this is a mathematical overcorrection, that it was driven by specific gender equity objectives.
Okay, but I want to play devil's advocate here. So what? Maybe they wanted to overcorrect to make up for past imbalances. Why does the author see this as a problem?
This is the core of the fairness paradox. He argues that once identity, in this case gender, becomes a binding selection criterion, merit cannot be the dominant factor.
It's a trade-off.
It's a mathematical seesaw. If you tilt the board to favor a specific demographic outcome that doesn't match the candidate pool, you must, by definition, filter out some candidates who might have been more qualified but didn't fit the demographic profile you're aiming for.
So he's saying that by trying to engineer this idea of fairness, you are mathematically diluting competence.
That's his argument. He suggests that QUT, in pursuit of an ideological goal, likely compromise its own institutional capability.
And to tie it back to the book's main theme,
this erodes agency. It erodes the agency of the institution to be excellent, and it erodes the agency of the individuals who are hired or rejected based on criteria they can't control.
It's a really heavy argument. It suggests that fairness and excellence are often, I don't know, natural enemies.
Or at least they are trade-offs. You can't maximize both simultaneously. And when a system prioritizes optics over competence, it creates a breeding ground for, well,
for fuckwits.
Exactly, a breeding ground for them.
There it is, the transition we were waiting for. So if these systems are prioritizing the wrong things, what does that actually look like on the ground?
It looks like the Department of Transport case study. This is the diagnosis segment of the book. And if you've ever dealt with a government agency, this story will, it'll raise your blood pressure.
I'm ready. Lay it out for us.
The author goes to the Department of Transport, the DOT, to pay a car registration bill.
A simple transaction.
The simplest. I owe you money. Here is the money. The most basic interaction in commerce.
He's ready to pay.
He is standing at the counter. He has the renewal notice. He has his driver's license. He has his credit card. He's ready to pay thousands of dollars. But the car is registered to his company.
Okay, a minor complication, you'd think.
You would think. The teller asks, "Are you the director of the company?" He says, "Yes, I am." She says, "Do you have a business card to prove it?"
A business card? Anyone can print a business card at home in 5 minutes. That proves absolutely nothing.
Exactly. But that was the rule on her screen. He didn't have a card with him, so she refuses to take the money.
Wait. He's standing there, money in hand. He has photo ID. He's the guy. And she won't take the payment.
He says to her, "I'm the director. It's in your database. Just type in the company name, and my name will come up as the director."
A logical, simple solution.
And then she said, "I can't do that."
Why? Is the system down? Some technical issue?
No. She says, if I do an ASIC search, that's the corporate database in Australia, it costs the department $2. And we can't charge you for that $2, so we aren't allowed to do it.
Hold on. Let me get this straight. She is turning away a payment of thousands of dollars because she isn't allowed to spend $2 to verify who he is.
Correct.
That is clinical insanity.
That is a functional diagnosis of a fuckwit. And let's be really clear here. The teller isn't a bad person. She isn't trying to be cruel or malicious.
She's just following the rule.
She is following a rule. Don't incur unrecoverable costs. But she has allowed the rule to completely consume the outcome.
The outcome being collect revenue for the state.
Yes. The rule prevented the outcome. He calls it procedural overreach.
She probably felt correct. She went home thinking she did a good job because she didn't waste that $2.
While in reality, she eroded the agency of the customer, wasted his time, delayed revenue for the state, and created friction where there should have been flow.
This is the trap, isn't it? We get so obsessed with the process that we completely forget what we're actually trying to achieve.
That's it in a nutshell.
So how do we break out of this? If the world is inherently unfair and the systems are broken and filled with this kind of logic, do we just give up?
No. This is where the book makes a really important shift from diagnosis to treatment. This is where we start steering.
Okay, let's talk about steering one toward agency. And specifically, this idea that sometimes to get your agency back, you have to break the rules.
Or at least you have to realize that the rules are just suggestions for how to be average.
Mm.
The author tells this fantastic story from his early career at a company called Gardner Parrott.
I loved the story because the stakes felt so real. He wasn't some philosopher then. He was just a guy trying not to get fired.
He was. He was in sales and he was barely hanging on.
Mm.
His boss, a guy named RK, had told him he was about to be speared.
Fired
for poor performance.
So no pressure.
None. He's bidding on a massive industrial painting job for a big client called Steggles. His company's bid is $127,000. His competitors are all bidding around $107,000.
So he is $20,000 more expensive in a market where price is probably the biggest factor. He's dead in the water.
He's supposed to be. He goes to his boss and asks, "Why are we so expensive? What's our edge? What am I supposed to say?" And his boss gives him the most corporate, empty, non-answer ever. He just says, "Because we're Gardner Parrott."
Which means absolutely nothing to the client holding the checkbook.
Nothing. So the author realizes, if I follow the rules, if I just submit this bid as is, I lose, I get fired, I have zero agency. So he decides to change the game.
Oh.
He looked at what Stegels actually wants. They don't just want paint on a surface. They want corrosion prevention.
Yeah.
They want to not have to worry about rust for 5 years.
They want the outcome, not the process.
Exactly. So what does he do? He constructs something called a retention money deal.
Okay, explain that for us. What is that?
It's basically a bet on himself and his company's work. He tells the client, "Okay, our price is $127,000, but I'll make you a deal.
Right.
You hold back $20,000 of that. You keep it in your bank account. If, after 5 years, there is no rust, you pay us the final $20,000. If there is rust, you keep it to pay for repairs."
Wow. So he's offering a 5-year warranty when everyone else is offering. What was the standard?
The industry standard was 12 months. He offered 5 times the value. He took all the risk off the client and put it squarely on his own company.
And I'm guessing he did not have permission to do this?
Absolutely not.
Hmm.
The company policy was strictly 12 months, no exceptions. He broke the rule to create the value.
Stegels, the client.
They loved it. It was a no-brainer for them. They signed the contract. He won the job.
But then he has to go back to RK, the boss who was ready to fire him. That must have been a tense conversation.
Oh, you can imagine. He walks in with signed contract.
Oh.
At first, RK is happy. Then he reads the terms. And he explodes. Veins bulging, screaming match. "You can't do this. You've exposed the company to 5 years of liability. Who do you think you are?"
And the author has the perfect comeback.
He just waits for RK to take a breath, looks him in the eye, and says, "But RK, we're Gardner Parrott."
That is so good. He used the boss's own empty branding slogan to justify the competence he just demonstrated.
It's a masterclass in agency. He realized that the rules were there to protect the system's internal culture, not to generate results. By breaking the internal rule, he secured the external result. He steered the outcome.
But there's a danger here, right? We can't just go around making things up or lying about what we can do. There's a difference between creating value and just faking value.
A huge difference.
And this leads to a really fascinating kind of philosophical concept in the book, simulacra.
Simulacra and perception laundering. This is deep stuff. It comes from the French philosopher Jean Baudrillard. A simulacrum is a copy without an original.
It's a symbol that has replaced the substance.
Yes. The map becomes more important than the territory.
Okay.
The author uses the cosmetics industry to illustrate this. And honestly, once you hear this, you'll never look at a moisturizer commercial the same way again.
He talks about the legal definition of what these creams can do.
Right. Think about it. If a cream actually changed your cellular structure, if it actually repaired collagen or reversed aging, what would it be?
It would be a drug.
It would be a pharmaceutical.
Uh-huh.
It would need FDA approval, years of clinical trials, prescriptions.
So by definition, anything you can buy off the shelf at a department store cannot work therapeutically.
Legally, it cannot. It can hydrate the dead skin cells on the surface. That's pretty much it. But look at how they sell it.
Oh, it's all science. It's lab coats, DNA helixes in the background, words like nanocomplex and bioactive peptides.
That is perception laundering.
Mm.
They are using the symbols of science, the simulacra, to sell a product that is legally prohibited from having a scientific effect.
They're selling hope dressed up as chemistry.
It's pure theater. And the author argues this isn't just about makeup. It's how our governments run. He points to the U.S. government shutdown of 2018-2019.
The one that was over the border wall funding.
Yes. It lasted 35 days. It was the longest in U.S. history. The author calls this moral theater.
How so? What does he mean by that?
Well, look at the actions versus the substance. The Republicans shut down the government to signal they were tough on borders. The Democrats refused to budge to signal they were resisting tyranny.
So they were performing for their respective bases.
Exactly. But while they were signaling, what was actually happening in the real world?
Well, TSA agents weren't getting paid. National parks were overflowing with trash. The actual machinery of government just stopped.
The symbol of governing, which was the fight, replaced the substance of governing, which is keeping the lights on. Both sides were acting as fuckwits. They eroded the agency of hundreds of thousands of workers and millions of citizens just to perform a play for their cable news audiences.
It's really depressing when you realize how much of modern life is just people in lab coats selling moisturizer that doesn't work or politicians fighting over walls that don't get built.
It is. But recognizing it is the first step to not being controlled by it. When you see the simulacrum, you can step back and say, okay, that's not real. I'm not going to invest my emotion or my energy in that.
So we need to see the world clearly. We need to pierce through the theater. Which brings us to steering two, counterfactuals. This is about how we think, right?
It's about steel manning. We've all heard of straw manning.
Right, where you build a weak caricature version of your opponent's argument so you can knock it down easily.
Steel manning is the opposite. You build the strongest possible version of the opposing view. You genuinely ask, how might the opposite be true?
And the author applies this to a real third rail topic, welfare.
He does. And just to frame this for everyone, this is his analysis of the system's logic, not a political statement. He contrasts two models of welfare, maintenance welfare and episodic welfare.
Let's break those down. What is maintenance welfare, according to the book?
Maintenance welfare is the model where we provide just enough support to keep someone alive, but we do it indefinitely. It's a steady, low-level drip. The author argues this is actually immoral.
Immoral, that's a very strong word. Most people would call that compassionate.
He argues it's immoral because it creates dependency. Think of it like an addiction cycle. If you have an addict and you keep giving them just enough money to survive but never force them to get clean, are you helping them?
Or are you just enabling their slow destruction?
Exactly. You're keeping them in a state of suspended animation. He says it erodes their agency. They become wards of the state forever.
So what's the alternative? What is episodic welfare?
Think of a hospital. You break your leg. You go to the hospital. You get a bed, food, drugs, surgery-intensive, expensive, front-loaded support. But the goal is not to keep you in that hospital forever.
Right. The goal is exit.
The goal is exit. To fix the leg so you can walk out under your own power. He calls it hospital-style restoration. Heavy support early on to restore capability, then it tapers off as you get stronger. The author argues this is the moral path because it aims to restore agency.
So why don't we do this? It sounds so logical. Why is the system so often stuck on maintenance?
Incentives. This is the perverse incentive problem he identifies. The author points out that the bureaucracy that runs the welfare system is paid for program continuation, not for program exit.
So if everyone got a job and left the welfare role tomorrow, a lot of bureaucrats would be out of a job.
Exactly. A cured welfare recipient is a lost customer to the bureaucracy. The system has an incentive to maintain the problem it was created to solve.
That's a cynical take, but you can see the logic.
He argues that we need to flip the script. Funding should be tied to successful exits. If you restore someone's independence, the system gets a bonus. If they stay dependent, the system has failed its mission.
It makes so much sense, yet it feels politically impossible. But it does highlight the importance of steering three scale. Because a lot of these problems come from the fact that these systems are just too big to function properly.
Scale and oversteer. Yes. This is the idea that systems fail when they get too big because they lose the ability to use judgment. The PayPal case study is the perfect and infuriating example of this.
Oh, man, the PayPal story. This is a complete nightmare scenario.
It really is. The author is in Europe with some friends. They rack up a bar tab. He pays it. And then he uses PayPal to request money from his friends to split the bill.
Standard stuff. Pizza money, beer money. Everyone does this.
The amount is $150. And suddenly his account is frozen.
Locked out completely.
Locked out. He gets a notification that he has violated the acceptable use policy regarding, wait for it, the funding of terrorism or money laundering.
For $150, that has to be the world's worst, most inefficient terrorist plot.
Right. If you're laundering $150, you're not a cartel boss, you're just really bad at math. But why did it happen?
Because some automated system, an algorithm, flagged it.
Because PayPal has millions of users. They cannot afford to have a human look at every single transaction. So they build a bot. And the bot is programmed to be hyper-cautious.
Right.
From PayPal's perspective, it is better to freeze 1,000 innocent accounts than to let one genuinely bad one slip through.
The system optimizes for its own risk reduction, not for the customer's agency or convenience.
That is oversteer in a nutshell. At scale, the system becomes a blunt instrument. It has to. It treats you like a potential criminal because it's cheaper than treating you like a person.
And the lesson for the listener is, don't put all your eggs in one of these big digital baskets.
Always have a backup. Yeah. Because at the margins, the algorithm will crush you and not even blink.
It's a chilling reminder that big often means fragile for the individual user. Let's move to steering four, consumption. This is a bit of a philosophical pivot. We hear a lot today about degrowth.
Oh yeah, humans are the virus. Stop consuming. Travel shaming.
The idea that the only moral choice is to shrink your footprint, to stop buying, stop flying, stop doing things.
The author just completely rejects this. He uses the metaphor of fouling the fish tank.
Which sounds pleasant.
Stay with me, he says. Imagine a fish in a tank. The fish eats. The fish excretes. It fouls the tank.
It's just biology. It can't not do that.
Exactly. Now, you can scream at the fish. You can stand there and say, stop shitting. You're ruining the water. But the fish cannot stop. To stop producing waste is to stop living.
So what's the solution? You can't shame the fish into changing its nature.
You get a filter. You clean the tank. The author argues that the goal of environmentalism shouldn't be the delusion of abstinence. It should be the engineering of waste management.
So focus on the output, not the input.
Exactly. Manage the externalities. Build better feedback loops. Build better filters. But don't hate yourself for existing. Don't hate yourself for consuming energy. That is what life is.
That's an interesting frame.
Agency means taking responsibility for the mess you make, not trying to cease existing to avoid making a mess in the first place.
I find that refreshing. It turns the problem from a guilt problem, which is paralyzing, into an engineering problem. And engineering problems are things we can actually solve.
Precisely. Now, Steering 5 gets into how we deal with other people. He calls it leadership and others.
And this is where he introduces the king versus tyrant model. And we aren't talking about Game of Thrones here, right?
No, these are archetypes of behavior. The king archetype uses power to propagate sovereignty.
What does that mean, to propagate sovereignty?
A true king wants the people around him to be strong. He wants them to be capable, independent, and free. He uses his power and his resources to lift others up, to make them more agentic.
And the tyrant?
The tyrant uses power to replace others' sovereignty. He wants to be the only one who decides. He wants dependents, not citizens. He wants control.
And the author connects this to his own life and his decision to leave Australia for a period of time.
He does. He felt that the Australian tax system at that point had become tyrannical in its function.
How so?
It was a combination of high taxes, so taking a large portion of his resources, combined with what he saw as poor service and massive bureaucracy. He felt he was working for a system that was treating him like a subject, not a citizen.
So he didn't protest. He didn't write angry letters to his representatives. He moved.
Relocation as the ultimate expression of agency. He calls this jurisdictional arbitrage.
I like that phrase.
Freedom is not a digital switch. It's not on or off. It's analog. It's a sliding scale. And if you are in a place, a state, a company, a relationship that is consistently eroding your agency, the most powerful move you can make is to physically leave. Go to a place where the rules favor you more.
Go where you were treated best.
Exactly. Don't waste your life fighting a tyrant. Just leave his kingdom.
That brings us to Steering 6. And this is the framework that really ties it all together. He calls it the agency map.
This is a quadrant model. It's really useful. Imagine a graph. The vertical axis is your agency, from low to high. The horizontal axis is others' agency, from low to high.
Okay, let's walk through the four corners of this map.
Top right. Quadrant one, he calls this gain. Your agency goes up, my agency goes up. This is a healthy trade. This is a good marriage. This is the king archetype in action.
Win-win, the ideal state.
Exactly. Bottom right, quadrant four, advantage. My agency goes up, yours goes down. This is competition. I win the tennis match, you lose. I get the job, you don't. The author says this is acceptable, even necessary, as long as it's within the rules of a fair game.
Okay.
Bottom left, quadrant three. Collapse. Yeah. My agency goes down. Yeah. Your agency goes down. Yeah. This is the addict and the enabler. This is a war of attrition. Just mutually assured destruction. Misery for everyone.
The place to avoid at all costs.
At all costs.
Yeah.
And then there's the top left. Quadrant two. Sacrifice.
This is the one that really tripped me up when I was reading it. This is where my agency goes down so that your agency can go up.
Self-sacrifice.
And we are taught our entire lives that this is noble. The mother who gives up everything for her kids. The employee who burns out for the good of the team.
And the author just slams the brakes on this. He explicitly rejects quadrant two as a valid long-term strategy.
Why? Why is that?
He argues that self-sacrifice is ultimately self-harm. And more importantly, it's unsustainable. If you constantly erode your own agency to help someone else, eventually you run out of agency. You burn out. You get sick. You become resentful.
And then you're no good to anyone.
And then you slip down into quadrant three collapse. Now you're both miserable.
It's the whole you can't pour from an empty cup idea.
Exactly, he says. You cannot lead if you are depleted. You cannot be a king if you're acting like a martyr. He argues that you have a moral duty to maintain your own agency first. It's the put your own oxygen mask on first rule before helping others.
It sounds selfish on the surface, but it's actually strategic. If I want to be useful to the world, I have to first keep myself strong.
Correct. Weak people cannot help others. Only strong, agentic people can. So preserving your own strength is the prerequisite for doing any good in the world.
Let's see this all in action. The book wraps up with a really compelling case study of a guy he calls TV.
Yeah.
This isn't a television. It's a pseudonym for a friend of the author.
Yes, TV. This story perfectly illustrates what he calls the 6 smooth moves of agency. It's a complete narrative arc.
So where does it start?
Move 1. Relocation. TV was a high flyer in Europe, great career, a lot of status, but he met a woman who lived in Australia. He decided that the relational agency, being with the person he loved, was more important to him than career status.
So he moved, she changed the arena he was playing in.
She didn't let his job define his geography. Then move 2, pragmatism. He lands in Australia, he needs a job to get established, he takes a role at a university.
Okay.
He's below his skill level, he's vastly overqualified, but he didn't let ego get in the way. He took the job to get leverage, to get cash flow, and a visa.
He secured his base of operations.
Yes. And then move 3, diagnosis. He's inside the university, and he looks around, he does the fuckwit check.
And what did he find?
He found the place was saturated with them. He realized that the leadership celebrated reducing losses rather than actually winning. He saw that ideology had replaced real-world feedback. If you were competent, you were actually punished because you made the incompetent people look bad and feel uncomfortable.
So he's in a toxic system, a tyrannical system that punishes competence.
Yes. Now, a quadrant 2 person, the self-sacrificer, would stay. They would say, I can fix this place. I'll work harder. I'll suffer through it to make it better.
And they would get chewed up and spit out. They'd burn out.
TV didn't do that. That leads to move 4, strategic exit. He realized the system was unreformable. He checked the opportunity cost. Staying meant erosion of his skills, his spirit, his agency. So he manufactured an external opportunity. He set up his next move, and he quit.
He fired the system.
He fired the system. And the lesson there is so powerful. Persistence is not always a virtue. Sometimes persistence is just a slow way to die. Knowing when to quit, knowing when to fold them, is a high agency skill.
It comes back to that driver analogy you used earlier. If the car is driving off a cliff, the correct move isn't to step on the gas. The correct move is to jump out of the car.
Exactly.
So we've covered a lot. The unfair forest, the math of diversity policies, the insanity of the DOT, the branding of Gardner Parrott, the logic of the fish tank, the danger of self-sacrifice. It's a comprehensive philosophy. But how does the author sum it all up? What's the final mental image he leaves us with?
He gives us Rob 80.
Rob 80.
This is his mental model. He imagines himself at 80 years old, sitting on a porch somewhere, yeah, looking back on his life.
And he asks this 80-year-old version of himself for advice.
In a way, yeah. He asks, what does Rob 80 care about? Does Rob 80 care that he won an argument on Twitter back in 2024?
Definitely not. Not even a little.
Does Rob 80 care that he politely followed a stupid rule at the DMV that wasted 3 hours of his one precious life?
No. Does Rob 80 care that he sacrificed his health for a boss who didn't appreciate it and replaced him a week after he left?
He probably regrets it deeply.
Right. So what does Rob 80 care about?
The author concludes that Rob 80 doesn't care about being right. He doesn't care about being seen as virtuous in the eyes of a broken system. Rob 80 cares about one thing, being cool and free.
Cool and free. I like that.
Did you live a life that was yours? Did you steer the ship? Or were you just cargo being transported?
That's the ultimate metric, isn't it?
It is. Freedom isn't a destination. You don't just arrive at free and then you can retire. It's a trajectory. Paragentism is about making the next move, just the next one, that slightly increases your options and slightly decreases your constraints.
Inch by inch, day by day.
Inch by inch. Steer away from the fuckwits. Steer toward agency.
So here's the provocative question for you, the listener, to chew on as you go about your week. Look at where you are spending your effort right now, at work, in your relationships, in your community. Are you building your own freedom, or are you just maintaining a system that doesn't care about you?
If the answer is the latter, it might be time to grab the wheel.
Thanks for diving deep with us. Keep steering.
To agentic.